This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Cynthia McKinney says Barack Obama has been role-playing Lincoln, Kennedy, and Dr. Martin Luther King, but now he's running out of time to play himself in the White House. Why does the U.S. make war on countries that pose no threat to America? And the Haitian people say no more rigged elections.
But first, President Obama's State of the Union address last week marked the start of the twilight of his presidency. We spoke with South Carolina activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray, editor of the book Killing Trayvon's, an anthology of American violence. Gray says Obama is still a skilled performer.
Obama right now is getting a lot of kudos for his style. He's getting style points. He gets style points for crying when he talks about the mass shootings and gun violence, but he doesn't cry for the thousands of people that he's killed with drone warfare. He hasn't shed any tears for all the thousands of people that are now being deported under his administration. So he has selective empathy, but he's getting a lot of style points. Of course, going to the and watching Aretha Franklin sing, you know, and bobbing your head and crying, all that is very good theatrics. But when you go back and look at his policies and go back and look at what he's done both foreign and domestically in regards to people of color around the globe, his record is the same as any record of the leader of the empire. He has perpetuated empire. He's fostered the myth of American exceptionalism. He has not really taken on the primary culprit that bedevils American culture, and that's race and racism and what that is. And now with Hillary Clinton on the ascension, he's pretty much promotes this whole idea, okay, a black person has had their turn, now it's time for a white woman. And that becomes the narrative instead of the politics of both candidates and of their party as nothing more than a corporatist party.
Some of us think it was very telling. He said during that State of the Union address that the United States, being by far the most powerful nation in the world that spends more money, arms, than the next eight nations combined, that no nation threatens the United States, and that if anybody did, that would put them on the path to ruin. But if no country is threatening the United States, why is the United States at war with so many other folks?
It was strange this week to watch the United States' reaction to the possibility of North Korea firing off a nuclear weapon or testing a nuclear weapon when this country is the only country that's ever used a nuclear weapon. It was strange to see, well, maybe not so strange to see, the U.S. media reaction and the GOP reaction to two American gunboats drifting into Iranian waters. And had an Iranian ship drifted into American waters, the news would be dominated right now about a possible terrorist attack. And so, you know, while the media cries about the sailors on those ships, they had their arms up. Well, they were in another country's water. They were on combat ships. They were given a greater amount of deference and respect as it relates to their humanity that Tamir Rice certainly got by the police, than Michael Brown got by the police, what Eric Garner got by the police, Sandra Bland, and we can go down the list, you know, hands up, don't shoot. It seems that Iran respected America's sailors' rights more so than America and the American Police Department respects the rights of black people and people of color in this nation. So back on this idea of power, You can have the most guns. You can have the most weapons. But we're at a time now where that's not necessarily the measure of power. There's something called moral power. And America doesn't have that moral power. It doesn't have any moral authority. And people around the world know this, and they're tired of it. The idea that what's going on in the Middle East, that we're somehow disconnected from it, we've created that. We created that after World War II, and the policies of colonialism or corporatism have driven our relationships with these countries. And now people are fighting back against that. So power is a relative term. If we spend all our money buying bombs, buying airplanes, buying ships, defense contractors, lobbyists, if we continue down this path, that is not a sustainable path. That's what lesson I thought the Russians had learned in Afghanistan, and with them trying to maintain some semblance of empire, it drove them bankrupt, and they're still trying to recover. I suspect that that's the track that we're on, and we'll become weaker and weaker. And it's not just about bombs, it's about the dollar and how strong the dollar is compared to the yen, compared to the euro, compared to the countries and the regions that are competing against us. And we're unreliable in the long run. So they're putting their money in other places. They're putting their money in Africa. They're putting their money in East Asia. And that's the power that we have to be concerned about.
The U.S. sets itself up as, in fact, the supreme moral authority. President Obama basically has put his signature on the doctrine of humanitarian military intervention, which is what he used to justify the destruction of Libya and the war against Syria.
Well, part of Obama getting away with perpetuating empire has a lot to do with the weakness of the American left, to be consistent, and this idea that left politics can somehow be expressed in the Democratic Party. I mean, as the old axiom goes, the parties are where movements go to die. And in the case of, even with the case of Black Lives Matter and their flirtation with partisan electoral politics, they'll find that it will just be about an elite group of people given franchise while everybody else gets the same thing they've always gotten. And that's a boot on the neck. But no, America certainly doesn't have any moral authority to preach to any other nation. With Obama extending the assassination program, he's going to go down in history as the assassination president. The city wants to talk about violence and mass murder. Well, that starts at the top. And, you know, if the nation engages in killing people and seeing people as collateral damage, killing people's husbands, their fathers, their daughters, their kids, supporting an apartheid regime in Israel, that's not sustainable. At some point in time, that all comes to an end. Of course, Obama and anybody that signs on to be the president of this enterprise signs on to be a mass murderer, and that's just the simple fact of it. The fact that a lot of folk, and black people especially, have been swayed by racial solidarity, have been swayed by the idea of a young black family in the White House and basically applauding him for his style points as opposed to his substance, that has been a problem. The good thing is that Obama has a year in office, and maybe people will come to their senses and start organizing against this unsustainable foreign and domestic policy that this country has been operating on for as long as I've been alive.
In reviewing President Obama's State of the Union address, it seems like lots of folks forget that he was an austerity president who tried like hell to make a grand bargain with the Republicans and came out swinging against Social Security.
Well, he and the Republicans, that was more theatrics than anything else coming out against Social Security, because regardless of how crazy some of these right-wing races are, at the end of the day, they want to go to their mailbox and get that monthly check. So, you know, that's more theatrics than anything else, and playing to Wall Street, because the idea is to try to privatize everything. I mean, people forget that Obama is a privatizer, wanting to private public education, and that's the other big mark against his legacy, this idea of setting up an elite public school structure as opposed to a structure where people come together, where it is the great equalizer. This idea of turning over public education to Wall Street and to the billionaires. That's going to lead to our ruin. So Obama hasn't been a transformative president in regards to the economy. He hasn't been a transformative president as relates to how people view race. The country has really become more racist and more reactionary during his term of office. And what people of color have gotten out of it, other than to have to deal with the meanness on the local level, economically, unemployment's still high. We still have high mortgage foreclosure rates. The HAMP program that Obama rolled out at the beginning of his administration was pretty much deemed a failure. The bankers got off and got to keep their money. Meanwhile, the wealth gap increased, and of course, in the black community, economically, things have gotten worse. People want to not talk about the turmoil in the black community economically. They look at Detroit, they look at Benton Harbor, they look at all this gentrification that's going on across the country. New York City, I think, still has a 50% black unemployment rate for black men. People don't talk about all those things, but those things are still in place, and those are the things that we're going to have to reorganize and fight once Obama leaves office. The trick that Obama had that caused him to have such high support among black folk beyond racial solidarity is that the attacks on him, the personal attacks, were meant to be symbolically attacks on black people. And a lot of people circle the wagons because of that. I'm hoping with that condition being gone, people will start seeing clearly what they have to fight against.
Or will blacks be stampeded into the Democratic ranks because of the presence of Trump?
Well, there's the local politics, and I was thinking about this before we did this interview, the campaign in Iowa, the campaign in New Hampshire, and then they come to South Carolina, and South Carolina is the black primary because 60% of the voters in the Democratic primary are black. And the reality is the local elected leadership are Democrats. So you can't take that out of the equation. I think that's the mistake that we often make. We want to see a new politics. We're supportive of third-party politics. And even in when we were trying to fight our way into the two-party structure, we used the third party. Down here, we used the United Citizen Party to break into that participation in the two major parties. So, you know, you're talking about how do you educate people on a local level to see the usefulness of third-party politics and building a third-party movement. That remains to be seen. So right now, for a lot of people, their choices are going to be, on the local level, Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. And a lot of the people that support Bernie Sanders are people that I will work with during non-election years. So for me, Bernie Sanders' campaign is useful if it's about organizing the people that you'll need on the local level to fight those local battles. They're more apt to be environmentalists. They're going to all accept their privilege, but at least they'll understand what white privilege is at some level. They're the people that are going to support fighting off some of this gentrification, although a lot of them are some of the hipsters that fuel it. But the Bernie Sanders campaign workers and supporters are going to be where the liberal left in the South gets its support after this is all over. So I might support a Bernie Sanders in a primary. That doesn't mean I'll support him in the general election or the Democratic Party in a general election. But I would certainly support, in a primary, people organizing a Sanders campaign with an eye on organizing their communities in the future.
One thing certainly did happen during Obama's tenure, and that is we see the glimmerings, at least, of a movement.
Well, you know, when you got so many people that are being shot down in the streets by the police, when the gap is so wide economically, when you have to pay off college loans for the rest of your life, so you start out in debt, and then, of course, there's the Internet that fuels a whole lot of stuff. If Internet is a useful tool for educating people. And so, yeah, there's a movement brewing. What young people in the movement have to understand is, A, they are going to get older. I mean, the young people seem to think that all these problems that they're confronting, that they just emerged and they're the experts on them. No, they have to understand the coherency and the consistency of our movement and what that means, and recognize that they're people that have fought this struggle for a long time, and everybody has a say in the movement. No question, young people are out in the streets, but it can't be just about being out in the streets and getting on TV and getting an adrenaline rush. It's got to be about, how do you really get into your community and organize change? How do you hold the police accountable? How do you really put independent citizens review boards that have power in place? How do you fight to get that? And that's more than just about blocking traffic or hanging signs on the interstate and carrying picket signs. That's about going into those communities. That's about running against people when they run for office who are not supportive of what you're doing. That's about organizing those lawsuits. That's about following those lawsuits all through the process. It's movements aren't just marching. It's having resources in place and empowering people on the local level. It isn't going from city to city to be on the front line. It's supporting those people in those cities to make changes that affect their lives where they are. It's not about this presidential campaign or that presidential campaign giving you credibility or being on MSNBC or CNN or wherever. It's about getting down and dirty in your community, figuring out, how do you fight off gentrification? How do you make sure that in some of this old public housing stock that's around the country, that people aren't just dispersed so that now people don't know the misery that people are going through? It's a lot of things. There is a movement growing, but folks have to recognize this is a continuation of something that a lot of people have worked on for a long time, and fighting the empire isn't a new deal.
And finally, after experiencing 8 years of having a black man in the most powerful position in the world, do you think black folks will still put stock in the idea that having black faces in high places is the measurement of progress for black folks?
Well, I mean, look, what we do, Glenn, is we build the contradictions, and we show people the contradictions, and you know, they have to make up their own minds. The biggest problem that black folk have in making it in this country is they measure themselves against white people, and they want to be accepted by white people. I often say, when you look back at the Civil War, people will ask the question, well, a lot of people didn't own slaves, but they sure went to fight for slavery. I say, yeah, because they wish they were slave owners in their minds. I mean, the American dream in a lot of people's minds is to hit the lottery, to be Bill Gates, to be Mark Zuckerberg, to be Oprah Winfrey. They want to hit the lottery. They want the American dream, and they believe that American dream is capitalism and materialism. That's what we're fighting, and that's a hell of a thing to fight. You know, this idea of being accepted by people who culturally you have to fight to get them to accept you. So when you look at social media, you see what people praise the most. They praise people who ascend through the institutions, who ascend through the structure, who are credits to their race. And so we're going to be fighting that battle to get people to look beyond materialism and to look beyond consumption and to look beyond capitalism, to really to understand capitalism and change to something else that's sustainable, that involves more cooperation among people, a different kind of economics. That's our job, to help teach that and help organize that, so that it isn't just a bunch of folk out there marching just so that they can get their piece or crumbs from the American slice of capitalist pie.
So what is the value of having had the Obama experience, if there is any value to it?
Well, the value is that you see the more things change, the more they stay the same. That's a value. And it's a value to know that we can demand more of politicians. And the next person that runs, the demand is higher, no question. And so there is a value. There's a value of advancing the idea that all people, only white people, can rule and run the government or run government and lead government. There's value in that. But you have to decide if the person that you're supporting is a fundamental change agent and he wants to change the nature of American society structurally. That's a whole different thing. And I don't think that the system would have ever allowed Obama to really make serious structural changes to it. that wasn't his purpose. His purpose was, as I said, this is their idea of the American dream, ascendancy, being a part of the system. And that system is a capitalist, Wall Street-supported empire.
That was Kevin Alexander Gray speaking from Columbia, South Carolina.
In his State of the Union address, Obama said that no country in the world dares to threaten the United States. But if nobody is threatening the U.S., then why is America making war against so many people? We put that question to Margaret Kimberly, editor and senior columnist for Black Agenda Report.
Because it's not about self-defense at all. It's about asserting imperialist power and about keeping control. That's why the United States has a military budget bigger than the rest of the world combined. It's just to use brute force to get its way. And it doesn't seem to matter how many guns, how many bullets, how many bombs, how many planes. The United States, especially in recent years, finds more and more countries to attack. And in the case of Libya, where they succeeded, in the case of Syria, where it hasn't turned out the way they thought, and where Assad has hung on, and now the Russians are involved, which is a good thing. But that's the cause of American aggression. It is just aggression. It's not to spread democracy. It's not to protect anybody. It's not to defend anyone. It's just for America to be the world's bully.
What do you think President Obama's legacy is in terms of foreign policy?
He's asserted imperialist power more than any other president. Reagan tried to kill Gaddafi and they said, oh, never mind. Obama actually did it. Other presidents thought about trying to take out the Syrian presidency. And it's interesting, you know, these were always, we were told, right-wing ideologies, the new American century and so forth, that the United States should just lay waste to the Muslim world, pretty much, and try to control them. But it was the Democrat who tried to make that a reality. And I don't know if he succeeded, but he's created more damage in the world. That ought to be his legacy of foreign policy. Libya, Syria, continuing the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the drone strikes. They can't take on Russia directly militarily, but the coup in Ukraine right next door, the sanctions, every effort, he's left no stone unturned in attacking the rest of the world.
Well, maybe his plans were in some ways more ambitious than his predecessors because he could anticipate less resistance from the American people than his predecessors.
Sure. Being a Democrat has given him cover. We talked about Reagan having Teflon, if you will, that nothing stuck to him. I think Obama certainly surpassed him in the Teflon territory, and that's partly because Democrats just caved when he was running for president. The hopes of having a Democrat in office, of having the first black president, the forces who came together to at least show public displeasure about Bush invading Iraq, just acquiesced with Obama, made excuses for him. So there was no group of people that he could look to. And, of course, Republicans wanted to do the same thing, so they weren't going to criticize him for that. They might say he didn't kill enough people or there should be boots on the ground, but the basic ideology was, interestingly, the same, which is what we're seeing with the presidential candidates, who all seem to have the same foreign policy. But Obama, especially in the black American community, was considered untouchable. People who, if a Republican or even if a white Democrat did the same thing, would have spoken up, silenced themselves for the past 7 years.
We can't point to much of a peace movement in the black community, not a movement that one could specifically identify as black.
No, not anymore. It'll be interesting to see what happens when he's a year from now, when he's no longer president. But we were always the most anti-war, the group least likely to be in favor of military adventures abroad. And we just joined up with white America and in some cases surpassed them in our support for these endless aggressions and interventions and invasions that Obama made happen.
I guess that could be explained by black folks identifying with power when the person in power is black.
Yes, we saw some of that actually when Bush was president with Condi Rice and Colin Powell, more so I think with Colin Powell, where people defended everything he did, and it was a foretaste of what we were going to see with Obama. Well, he's just doing his job. Well, what do you expect from him? You know, he can't do anything else. And Obama, that was mixed with the joy of the person with the top job being black, and the excuse-making turned into support for things that in the past it would have been unthinkable for black people, to say nothing that an American president murdered Gaddafi. If the president had been white, I think even if a white Democrat had done that, there would have been opposition to it, public opposition. But because it was Obama, it didn't matter.
Yes, as if Obama was pulled kicking and screaming into these aggressions all over the world. One of the results of his pivots here and there is that Russia and China have grown closer than ever in terms of their economic and military partnership.
Sure. Somebody has to find some way to try to counter American power. America is, unfortunately, the only superpower in the world, but that doesn't mean that other countries are going to sit by and do nothing. Both China and Russia are being pressured by the United States in various ways. Countries border one another, so of course they're going to come up with trade agreements and other alliances and treaties between the two in order to protect themselves from the United States. It's something that should have been expected. I don't know if they didn't expect it or didn't care. I sometimes think they make these decisions and don't really think about the consequences.
Now, what could the consequences be?
Well, you know, there's always a danger of going too far. We've seen in Syria where the Russians complained or vetoed at the Security Council. They did not help Gaddafi. They abstained from the vote on the no-fly zone, which they had the right to veto outright, and I think they live to regret doing that. It's hard to say what their thinking was. They had to get their own house in order, so to speak, and they've had their own pressures. But for the last 3 months, the Russians have stepped up in Syria and are helping their ally with their bombing campaign, which has been successful in pushing back ISIS, the Islamic State, which the United States pretended to fight but really wanted them to take out Assad. So that is a consequence. That's an example. Eventually, someone else will also step up, and it's a good thing, ruin America's plans.
The whole world, except for most of the American people, know that the United States and its allies have been funding jihadists in Syria and in Libya and in other places. But some people think President Obama is pulling back on that support for jihadists. Do you think there's any truth in that?
Well, I think they go back and forth. I think they change their minds sometimes because there are complications, obviously, in backing people like that. This has been going on since the 70s. It started with Carter in Afghanistan. And the results have been disastrous. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that bin Laden was one of those allies of the United States. We see how that turned out. And these are forces that can't be controlled. They have their own agenda. So the short-sighted thinking says, back the jihadists, they'll get Gaddafi out. Back them, they'll get Assad out. But then that creates other problems with the Islamic State and other jihadists having their own agenda and doing what they want to do. So they threaten Saudi Arabia, who is America's friend, as an example of a complication that the United States does not want to see. So I think they blow hot and cold. Some days it's like, okay, you know, we got rid of Gaddafi, so that was a good thing. So it seems like you can possibly get Assad out, take a little longer than you think, then Russia steps in. So maybe it's not such a good idea. Then the Saudis strike back at Yemen to fight Iran, but they're also being pressured by the Islamic State and others who want to take them out. So it's as the old saying goes, what a tangled web we weave when we practice to deceive. And so the United States is forced to go back and forth in making these foreign policy decisions.
every 4 years, people are urged to rally around the Democrats, because if not, the Republicans will blow up the world. But how deep do you think the line is that separates Democrats and Republicans in foreign policy?
Well, there isn't any. I mean, just watching the debate, they all have the same foreign policy. The United States has to isolate Russia. I hate Putin more. No, I hate Putin more. No, I'd have more sanctions. I'd never speak to him. And nobody says anything different, including Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Well, Hillary's always been very warlike, but the supposedly left-wing Bernie Sanders sounds the same. So I think it's pretty clear that there's some nuance in difference about how much money to spend or who to work with or whether you do or don't need boots on the ground. But it's essentially a continuation of imperialism. All of the candidates, Democrats and Republicans, go straight down that line.
And we have to remember that half the Congressional Black Caucus voted for continuing the bombing of Libya back in 2011.
Of course they did. They never opposed anything Obama did. None of the Democrats did. I believe there's only one House member now who is on record as opposing the Obama policy in Syria. And everyone else has just gone right down the line. No opposition. There's allegedly a progressive caucus. I don't see how progressive they are. The Black Caucus is a shell of its former self. So they are very reluctant to oppose Obama. I think they're pressured into it. I think the racism of many of the Republicans who oppose Obama also pushes them. Those who might stop and think, unfortunately, they start worrying about some right-wing Yahoo being mean to Obama, and then they see themselves as having to support him. And not supporting humanity or supporting the beliefs they used to have and used to espouse. It's all very sad.
And yet, interestingly, at least in his last pronouncements, Donald Trump seems to be more peaceably inclined towards Syria and other parts of the world than Barack Obama.
Yes, it's interesting. There has always been that strain among Republicans that people say they're non-interventionists or isolationists. You can call it what you will, but every now and again there is some sanity. It's unfortunate that it's only Trump, because then that point of view gets discredited. And people say, see, you think you can make deals with Russia, that's what Trump says. Or we shouldn't try to get Assad out, that's what Trump said. So it's sad that he is the only one who has questioned foreign policy at all. And unfortunately, there are a couple of other Republicans who used to sound that way, but even they have caved in. And so we are stuck with whoever the next president is, assuming it's not Donald Trump, will follow the Obama doctrine.
So in the United States, the empire's on a roll, not necessarily so in the rest of the world.
Yes, it is. I think the effect of the Democratic Party effectively killing off left politics, this is the result of the Democrats doing that. So now there is no one, well, I should not say no one, but a minority, a small minority, who oppose imperialism. And everyone else is embracing it. They may not call it that, but going along with the Democratic president or going along with the first Black president who does what Republicans did and then some is to back the empire and to be pro-war.
That was Barr senior columnist Margaret Kimberly speaking from Harlem.
Cynthia McKinney ran against President Obama on the Green Party ticket in 2008. The former sixth-term congresswoman from Georgia recently earned her Ph.D. for Leadership and Change from Antioch College. McKinney wrote her dissertation on the late Venezuelan socialist leader Hugo Chavez. She appeared recently on peace activist David Swanson's Talk Nation radio program and was asked if there was any real difference between Obama and George Bush's policies toward Venezuela.
Well, I think if anything, what happened was the Venezuelan leadership was perhaps more receptive because of the deceptive nature of President Obama. And by that, what I mean is that there was this aura that had been created during the campaign, mind you, that President Obama was going to be different. And during the campaign, candidate Obama, if you recall, was Abraham Lincoln, he was Franklin Roosevelt, he was John Kennedy, he was Martin Luther King Jr. He was all of these
Luke Skywalker
personalities that we revere as personalities that represented some grand moment in the history of the United States. And so people literally were crying. I remember when he went and spoke at the what used to be the Berlin Wall, and the Germans were literally crying because they thought that the United States was finally about to turn the page. Well, I can tell you from the WikiLeaks documents that I surveyed and I read all there's little more than 2,200 WikiLeaks documents that refer by name to Venezuela or the Bolivarian Republic or Hugo Chavez. And there was no change. Absolutely no change. And in fact, in many respects, I think the openness that people received President Obama was abused and allowed for the nefarious policies that had been openly objected to insinuate themselves into relationships that were based on the idea that this was going to be different.
That was former Georgia Congresswoman and presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney.
The poor island nation of Haiti is scheduled to hold another round of elections on January 24th. The problem is almost nobody wants the vote to happen except the candidate for the ruling party, backed by the United States. The first round of elections held last year were widely viewed as rigged. However, the United States is demanding that the presidential vote go ahead without fixing the process. Jake Johnston, a researcher for the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research, says Haitians refuse to tolerate another fraudulent election.
It's not just opposition politicians who are formally against this process, but also a wide range of human rights organizations, diaspora organizations, religious leaders, etc., that have come out against this current process. And so it really does reflect sort of a wide swath of society. And on the other hand, those who are sort of pushing the January 24th date and pushing forward with the election, in addition to the government of Haiti, is also the international community, largely represented by the UN, the Organization of American States, who is observing this current electoral process, as well as the United States.
Yes, the United States says it is waiting impatiently, tapping its fingers on the table, anxious for this election to proceed without the kinds of changes that people are looking for.
Yeah, that's right. And so the first round presidential election took place in October, and it was followed by, you know, allegations of massive fraud and other denunciations of irregularities on election day. The second round was originally scheduled for December 27th and has been delayed twice already. And so an evaluation commission was formed to look at some of the irregularities from October and sort of suggest a way forward. Now, this commission was not able to sort of have the time or access to fully investigate what happened, but what they did suggest was sort of some changes that could be made, and also they were very clear that continuing with the current process under the current electoral authority would not be seen as legitimate and credible in the eyes of Haitians. And yet, just days after that report was released, the government issued a decree establishing January 24th as the date. That was just a little over 2 weeks after this report was issued, and clearly not enough time in the eyes of both the members of the commission as well as those observing the situation to actually implement any of these changes or the majority of these changes that have been called for.
An independent electoral evaluation commission found that almost half of the election sheet tallies in the previous count were filled with irregularities.
Yeah, that's right. And so I think there's been some sort of misconception around what they did and didn't find. what they strongly suggest is that there were significant irregularities and sort of akin to fraud, similar to fraud. I think, you know, what the members of the commission sort of established was that they didn't truly have enough time to dig into the question of who was responsible, who was benefiting from it, and what the sort of overall impact of it was. And one of the recommendations was actually a sort of a further analysis of these problems, which clearly from their investigation were significant. And I think that's one of the biggest things we haven't yet seen is any sort of further look at what the problems were and how they may have impacted the race.
It's been written that the Provisional Election Council, the people who were charged with running these elections, now is the most despised institution in Haiti. Is that hyperbole?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so necessarily. And I think you've seen members in the last weeks and even just today, just within the last sort of couple hours, another member of the Electoral Authority resigned their post. So now three of the nine members are actually not currently part of the organization. And I think this speaks to the sort of lack of credibility and legitimacy that they have in terms of being responsible for carrying out elections. And, you know, one of the recommendations of this commission, one of the sort of prerequisites from Jude Celestin, who was set to face the government's candidate, Jovenel Moïse, in the runoff, was these wholesale changes to the Electoral Council, that it really had been discredited to the point where there had to be significant changes in its structure in order to have a fair and legitimate election. And that's something that, while there have been some resignations, we haven't seen a sort of changing of the guard there at the Electoral Authority.
This is an electoral authority whose president has admitted that back in 2010, he changed the results of the election in order to favor the person who wound up becoming the president, Michel Martelly, the U.S.-backed candidate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, looking back at 2010 has significant lessons for what we're witnessing today and how this process is playing out. So in 2010, this is the last election that was held. Again, there were significant problems. There were allegations of fraud. And in that case, the international community publicly backed those allegations. They disputed the announced results, and they sent a mission of foreign experts funded by the U.S. to Haiti to investigate the election. Unfortunately, rather than actually investigate the election, they simply overturned the results and changed the results, kicking Jude Celestin, the man who's now in second place and supposed to participate in the runoff, for Michel Martelly, the eventual president. Now, that sort of kicked off a five-year period, the last 5 years of Martelly's term, where he was seen as illegitimate by a wide swath of the country, who saw that process not as a democratic reflection of the Haitian people's will, but of the intervention of the international community. And when you look at the role that they're playing today in supporting the status quo and supporting an election that both observer groups, human rights groups, as well as the opposition politicians have criticized as illegitimate, and yet the international community has very much backed the current process and, in fact, is urging each side to sort of have this election as soon as possible, even if these changes have not been made. And I think, you know, whether or not that is a true change of policy, it's certainly been interpreted in Haiti as picking favorites and showing the hypocrisy of the international community in Haiti.
And what is described as the international community at the core is the United States and France and Canada, countries that backed the coup in 2004 in Haiti.
You know, it's true. And I mean, I think it also includes, you know, the core group is sort of the main actors. It also includes representatives from Brazil and Argentina and some Latin American countries, which is an interesting dynamic as well as the United Nations troops, the MINUSTA, which have been in the country for over 10 years now and have sort of had a big impact on the sort of political process and allowing Haiti to sort of form its own democracy. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, this isn't anything new. I mean, democracy in Haiti is relatively new. The first free elections were actually in 1990. And yet throughout that brief history, the international community has intervened multiple times to sort of stunt that growth and stunt that domestic development of democracy. I think, you know, in order for that to truly happen, the international community needs to take a step back and allow Haitians to truly reach these solutions on their own and to find the most appropriate path forward.
And what you seem to be describing as a kind of consensus that's developed in the Haitian political community involving most of the actors, that Haiti shouldn't be railroaded or ramrodded through this kind of defective process.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, you look at the sort of talking points on the other side from the U.S., from the OAS, from the Haitian government, is that Martelly's term is up on February 7th, and they desperately want a handover of power on that date. And so they are sort of pushing an election as soon as possible in order to stick to that timeline. And I think the sort of downside risk to that is, again, 5 more years of a government that right from the get-go is contested by the streets, by the opposition parties, and that lacks credibility and legitimacy in the eyes of Haitians. And, you know, this has sort of impacts far beyond just the short term, you know, for the duration of that period of time, next 5 years. Whereas sort of taking a little bit more time, even if it does lead to either a transitional government or some sort of caretaker institution in the short run, can sort of solve the bigger questions of democratic legitimacy and government legitimacy in Haiti for the longer term.
And what are the prospects for this election coming off on January 24th, or of involving most of the participants?
Yeah, well, to this point, you know, the main actors who have been pushing the election have stuck to this date as an important date and one that they will stick to. You know, but I think there is plenty of reason to question whether or not that will truly happen. You know, back in December, the election was scheduled for the 27th, and it wasn't until very soon before then that it was actually delayed. And it wouldn't be surprising to see the same thing happen this time. Jude Celestin, again, who came in second in the first round, according to the official results, and would be set to participate in the runoff, had indicated probably in the most clear way he has since this crisis began that he had no intention of participating in the election and was actively opposed to the process. I think, you know, if you have a runoff election with just one person, it's pretty clear that that won't be seen as legitimate, and certainly, you know, indicates that there may be another delay this time around.
Is there any indication that the Obama administration is going to relent on its insistence?
Well, you know, I think in the end, they're not the ones who are going to be able to make this decision. You know, there's been a tremendous resistance to what's happening in Haiti, and that's really the force that will be key in determining how this process moves forward.
Jake Johnston of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington.
The Democratic Republic of Congo will hold elections later this year, although it is not clear if President Joseph Kabila will run for a third term. At least 6 million Congolese have died as a result of invasions of the country by U.S. allies, Uganda and Rwanda, and now the U.S. is fomenting regime change in neighboring Burundi. According to Kambali Musavili of Friends of Congo, the U.S. has conspired against the Congo for more than a century.
The backdrop to look at the U.S. action in the region is to really look at history. The United States was the first country to recognize Congo as a personal property of Leopold in the late 1800s. The United States backed the killing of Patrice Lumumba, the CIA operator in the Congo, and contributed to the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first elected prime minister of the Congo. Not only that, they supported a dictator was imposed on the Congolese people for 32 years. When the U.S. was done with supporting the dictator, they supported an invasion of the Congo by Rwanda and Uganda, which has taken the lives of millions of Congolese. And as we see here unfold today, this is the same nation now criticizing Kabila of saying that he should not stand the third term. That's something I joined the U.S. in saying this is the correct thing to do, but I'm very clear. The Kabila of 2014, 2015, today also, is the same one in 2001 that the U.S. backed. He's the same Kabila in 2006 that the U.S. backed. So he has not changed. He has not changed his tactics. So when the U.S. is coming in what people can describe being on the side of the Congolese people, it's not because they actually want to see real change in Congo. It's because they know that the people of the Congo will be successful in transforming the country tomorrow. And as they are ready and changing the country, U.S. interests will be at stake. So they want to be sure when the new and elected leaders of the Congo are coming into power that they still have access to the mines in Congo, that they could come to the inauguration of the new president in the Congo and say, remember how I helped you get into power and still have unfettered access to Congo's resources. I'm clear of that.
Well, nobody's trying to deny the United States or others access to the resources of Congo, but at a fair price and based on mutual respect.
Exactly, and that's been the struggle. But there is this unspoken policy in Washington about Congo or even Africa as a whole is this is where we go get our resources without any accountability. I mean, can you imagine the death toll? Can you imagine having 6 million people dying in Europe to get access to oil and no outrage whatsoever from the world? That's what has happened to the Congolese. The Congolese have witnessed their resources flying out of the country for centuries. Not only the mineral resources, even the human resources through the slave trade. And today, as we speak, as you say, what Lumumba wanted for the Congo, Lumumba clearly stated that he wanted the resources of the Congo to benefit the Congolese people. Why can't Congolese use their own oil, their own coal sand, without dying for it, without having this imposition of any time the United States need copper, they come to the Congo. If they need to bomb Japan for Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they go to Shikolombe mine in Katanga, take the uranium there, and that's the uranium that they use to bomb Japan. If they need to take drones, they're going to take it from Gurume in Katanga, also in Congo, and get access to Congo's cobalt and provide that to other weapon manufacturers so that they could build drones that's bombing people in Afghanistan, Pakistan, all over the Middle East. So Congolese are tired of that. Congolese are saying, we do not want to be the slave of the West anymore. We want to be able to control our own affairs, and we want the resources of our country to benefit our people before it benefits the world. And that's been the central battle for Congolese since 1885. It's always been about who's going to control Congo's resources and for whose benefit. But in the final analysis, I'm confident that the Congolese people will prevail. And they know they're not alone around the world, that there are other people of goodwill who are fighting along their side so that they are successful in transforming the country. Because if they are successful, if Congo is free, Africa is free.
And so the threat always is, if the Congolese people don't choose a leader to the U.S. liking, then U.S. allies in Rwanda or Uganda will invade the country and stir up tensions and cause further deaths, or invade neighboring Burundi and have the same effect, causing turmoil in the whole region.
It is indeed a very big threat and risk that we can see happen. As you clearly pointed out, what is unfolding in Burundi is quite disheartening, where there is a political crisis in Burundi and refugees are flocking into Rwanda. They are fleeing the crisis. But while in Rwanda, the Rwandan government is fomenting a rebellion against Burundi. They have done so in Congo. And there is no opposition from Washington right now around the subversion happening in Rwanda. And that's also a political risk in Congo. So that's why we have to remain vigilant. When Congolese are fighting for change, they're fighting for the whole region. They're fighting for the entire continent. And it's so important for them to be successful. I mean, can you imagine having one of Africa's richest country being destabilized for hundreds of years? What would happen if Congo today was a stable country and could use its river to provide electricity to the whole African continent because the Congo River has the potential? Can you imagine the type of advancement in technology, in infrastructure that the African continent will benefit from? So that is what is happening right now. What is happening is that Africa's future is being taken away from Africans by making sure that one of the richest country on the African continent, and arguably around the world, is not able to reach its full potential where Africans can benefit from it. I'm aware of the risk. I'm worried about the risk. And my hope is for those who are fighting for truth, for justice, and for the liberation of Africa, to make sure to stay abreast of the situation in the Congo, in the region, and inform those who are not aware to shine light on the issue when we have more people watching the United Snakes, which we call the United States, of its dealings on the African continent, we have a better chance of actually winning the battle. And I always use that example. What if Lumumba had a Twitter account when the CIA was organizing his killing and the killing of his friends and colleagues and comrades? That's the challenge we have, to make sure that people in the United States are aware of the dealings of the United States abroad, so that our taxpayers' money in this country is not fueling the killing, is not paying for the deaths of millions in the Congo and across the African continent.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.